Well, hey, everybody, this is Dave. I hope you're all doing great. Any follow-up thoughts or questions from our first seminar? Or any additions to the questions you've sent in, or those who haven't sent in questions about a focus and a destination? I appreciate everyone who sent in questions, and I may even deviate some from the outline even beginning in this seminar to incorporate some of the discussion for that. But any thoughts or questions, including about unprecedented experiences? What you got? If you would just say your first name at least, identify yourself, and then add or ask anything you'd like. Any clarifications or follow-up thoughts or questions from our first seminar? Anyone? If not, I will deal with feeling lonely, and we'll move directly into our seminar, and then we'll have maybe a bit more time at the end. You know, final call, questions, thoughts, check-ins? Okay, I'm going to put us on lecture mode. Hang on for just a second. Okay, we're going to talk in this seminar about mastery of states of mind. And this, I believe, is one of the fundamental things that you'll be doing, probably already are, but will be doing again and again with your clients, is to help them regulate states of mind and manage emotions. That is the most salient success strategy in a number of studies of someone being able to do exactly what they want to do in whatever position or area that they're in. So this, I believe, will be something you'll be dealing with regularly in helping clients to look at helping them regulate state of mind. And we'll talk some about how to do that, some of the ideas behind it, and the mind and brain sciences applied. And I'm responding to a couple of questions or comments about case illustration. So that's where I may depart a little bit. And again, I really appreciate you sending in responses and things that you're interested in. So first, to understand states of mind. A state of mind is a mind-body state. It's like a specific software program that determines how we perceive and then how we process information. In other words, how we respond. So a state of mind is a particular set of emotions, memories, mental models, behavior patterns. So a key element in working in mentor coaching with someone is to understand and resonate with their experience, the empathic experience that you have with them, to resonate with understanding how they're thinking, feeling, the models that they use, to then help them find a way to self-regulate as a first order of business. So here's the principle. State always comes before strategy and story. So someone, and we touched on this last time, someone engages you for a coaching session and they just had a really upsetting experience and they want to get settled and talk with you about some things they had planned. Since state comes first, the first response you may consider is resonating with their state of mind, such as, I hear how upsetting that is for you, or how overwhelmed, or whatever you resonate with that you hear them saying that may capture that so that they know that you know. So here's the principle behind that. Draw, if you would, a circle on a page, just a clean page of paper. draw a circle on it. In the middle of that circle, draw a stick figure. That's your client. Now, if you want that client to really engage with you and have a meaningful conversation with you, your challenge is to get inside that circle. So how do you do that? It's not by talking about you. It's not your story. It's you resonate with the client and the client's experience. When you get in that circle together and the client knows it, you can go someplace new together. Now, a few of you have heard this story, but it's still, after all this time, the most singular illustration that was brilliant on this person's part to coach me about what needed to be done. I was working with, many years ago, before I discovered mentor coaching, in psychoanalysis with a woman executive, and I offered an interpretation that I thought would be really useful for her, helpful. And there was a pause, and she finally got up on her right elbow, looked back at me, my analytic chair, and said, "No, Kruger, first you've got to be with me before I can go someplace new with you." That's the most succinct that I've ever heard it put in all of the studies and in all of the ways of examining this. We have to be with a client before they can go someplace new with us. So you move into that circle, then you can go someplace new together. The client will know you get it, and that's the framework of collaboration, with the client as point of reference and the client story being what you co-create and develop it and develop together. So understanding states of mind is important, because as each state of mind is its own software program, usually there's kind of a seamless blend. When we're grounded and centered, totally present as a coach, we will be able to understand and resonate in an empathic way with the client's experience. And from that grounded and centered state, we have access to our intuition. More on that later. But this is a beginning, and it's important to recognize. So here's an example of how a state of mind can be distinct when it's not integrated in that seamless way of being grounded and present. An example. You put a rat in a maze. You teach the rat to get to the cheese. It can go again and again. Now, and it becomes automatic. Now, before you take another rat, you take this rat, and before you teach it to get to the cheese, you inject it with just a little bit of amphetamine, just enough to simulate maybe a stress state. You teach it to get to the cheese, and it can go again and again. Now, with this rat, you take away the amphetamine. It still has, in a part of its brain, exactly the path to get to the cheese, but it can't access it without that specific state. It can literally, in that maze, die of starvation, even though it has in a part of its brain how to get to the cheese. Reinject the amphetamine, it immediately goes to the cheese. State-dependent learning and state-specific memory. Think about like a practical or common application. You can't think of somebody's name. It's right on the tip of your tongue, but you can't get it. And then you move on. Later, you're relaxed, you're thinking about it, and then boom, it comes to you. That access is an example of a state of mind being a mind-body state like specific software, and each mindset has its own software system. And a mindset, a state of mind, and the accompanying software determines what we perceive, how we process, and then how we perform. So this is why I believe it's important, and why much of the beginnings of some coaching sessions will be about helping someone regulate a state of mind and get to. Let me give you an example. This is something that I thought of in response to a couple of the questions, but also it I believe illustrates this in a practical way. And I'll tell you, and I can send you, I don't think it's in your outline, I can send you, this is a micro system to regulate states of mind. It's a one page, and I'll tell you how I got there and how I hatched this idea, and this is the prototype client who I did this with. So let me tell you her story and our story. And it will illustrate this, I think, in a way that will make it totally understandable. Barbara was working with, I'll call her Barbara, was working with me in mentor coaching on some executive leadership strategies that she was doing very well in her company that she co-owned. And she mentioned right before the Thanksgiving holidays, with some embarrassment, that, you know, Dave, I'd like to talk about something different during this session. I said, sure. I'd ask her what she wanted to talk about, and then she said, it's different. She said, Thanksgiving is coming up. Every year, my family has one big gathering. This year, it's Thanksgiving. My parents, brother, sister, and their families all come together for a holiday weekend, usually 3 days. I resolve before I leave that this time is going to be different. I will not get into arguments or struggles with my parents and brother and sister. I can usually last most of the first day. Then something happens and I just lose it. I get in a fight with one of my family. That escalates to a fight with all of them. Is there anything you can help me with this? I said, I hear how frustrating it is when you want an enjoyable holiday with your family. And she wholeheartedly agreed. She, I think, knew that I got it. I asked, when you're in the middle of that upset and arguing with them, what's the age of that conversation for you? She knew exactly what I was talking about. She did not pause. And she said, early adolescence. I'm 13 instantly and totally at that time, and I'm stuck there for the rest of the visit. I asked her what she was aware of that specifically triggered her reaction. She described a particular look from her dad, a word from her mother that would just set her off, a gesture from her brother that would immediately provoke her to get angry and feel criticized. Her reactive state of mind instantly transported her to that early adolescent time capsule. So I recommended that she schedule a time to do a brainstorming session with herself to reflect on two things. I asked her to take a whole page of paper and put three vertical lines so she has four columns. In the first column, to list each specific emotional trigger that you've been aware of. And I cautioned her to be very present and grounded and centered, to do that as an observer, to not get triggered and go into it as she was doing that. And that was the scheduling an appointment with herself to look at this and write it down. And the second column, to label that your reaction to each trigger, whether it's a thought, a feeling, a behavior, negative self-talk, or whatever. And then pause, and maybe 24 hours later, day or two later, come back, but it had to be before Thanksgiving, come back and look at the third and fourth column. The third column would be a mantra, and I'll tell you how I explained that. In just a moment. The mantra is a cue, a focus, a physiology to get immediately grounded and centered. And I'll go over that with you guys in just a minute. And the fourth is, for each emotional trigger, what would be her ideal response, her ideal behavior? It's useful to have that pre-planned, because when she goes across horizontally from the trigger ultimately to an ideal behavior and repeats that enough, it becomes hardwired. So this is a neuroassociative change that she's making. And we'll talk about that later, but just that this, the third and the fourth column that she approached for each emotional trigger, again, not getting triggered, but just looking at it. And she needed an explanation to respond that she wanted to have this brainstorming session with herself to address the couple of other areas, and wanted especially to understand the mantra. So what I described as the mantra, the cue, the focus, the physiology, column three. A cue is to initiate that process. In other words, to have something that's a gesture or a word that would put her in a focused state to do the three things, the cue, the focus, physiology. The focus phrase, I'll come back to that and give you an example. A focus phrase is to align the energy field of her brain. For example, relaxed and powerful, to say something to herself. And the physiology is a deep breath for relaxation, to breathe in relaxation and breathe out tension. The prototype study with this is Roger Reed inherited a basketball team that was 217th in their division nationwide out of 217 teams in free shot percentage, dead last. So what he did was initiate a mantra when they practiced free shots. He would have them dribble twice, say at the same time a focus phrase such as relaxed and smooth, something that fits the function, and then at that time they take the dribble and say that, a deep breath in to breathe in relaxation and breathe out tension so they get grounded and centered, and then take the shot. So in that dribble, those 3 or 4 seconds, those three things are happening. The mantra is happening. So they practice in that way. An additional aspect was that during practice, he would suddenly blow a whistle, have them go to the free shot line, shoot 2 free shots. If they made it, they got a break. If they didn't, they did 4 laps. This simulated the performance flow that they would need, because you don't get to line up and shoot 30 free shots in a game and count your best. You're fouled. You're probably on tilt, and you got to get grounded and centered very quickly. So this is kind of a backstory of that. In 2 years, they were number one in their division nationwide. So this is something, those of you who have trained with me have heard this and related stories. What I do before, say, a keynote is to put my index finger and thumb together on both hands, have them touch, do the little infinity sign. That's below the table or in my lap where there are no witnesses, and since I don't carry a basketball. So in 2 to 3 seconds, that cue alone boots up the state that I want. I've done it enough times that, boom, I'm there. It may be a phrase, but the phrase needs to fit what you want to do. So relaxed and powerful is not something you want to say as you want to get to sleep more effectively. You may want the focus phrase to align the energy field of your brain to focus on, you know, relax to sleep. Make it fit. And you know, this is a story for a later time, but an application here is that in working with golfers, the driver phrase, the mid-range shot, and the putter phrase all need to be different, because it's different. So what she did then was to decide to touch her ring as she wore a ring, and she didn't want to show. She touched her ring and did this practice and noticed that she would get better and better at it. When she came back, she said, best Thanksgiving ever. And she remember that I said, now look, this is new, it's different. You may want to call a timeout. This is not the NBA. You don't have a limited number of timeouts. You may want to call a timeout. If you're having any difficulty with this or find yourself slipping, you know, walk away from the table. Take a walk outside. Go to the bathroom. Splash water in your face. You can call a timeout just to go to the next room or go to the kitchen and get a glass of water, anything, just to reestablish that being grounded and centered. So that was that's an application of this process. And I'll send you guys a copy of the neural. Actually, you can see it if you're interested in me sending it. I will. There's a free webinar, underline free, that will elaborate a bit more of what we're talking about right now. At the very bottom of my website, mentorpath.com, M-E-N-T-O-R-P-A-T-H. Click on the link that says webinars on states of mind, master states of mind. So this is the hard work miracle of doing something like this, but it's going to be applicable for your work with clients, because there may be times that you may need to spend a brief time, even just a minute or two, to do a mindfulness meditation with a client. That there have been two or three instances in beginning a session where a client was so upset that something just happened. And they're really upset and said, I wanted to call because I didn't want to leave you hanging, but I've had this happen. I think I need to reschedule so that, you know, I can really make use of our time. I said, I understand. Would you like us to do together? In one instance, it was a one-minute mindfulness meditation. I only asked for 1 minute. Another, a progressive relaxation. So when I did, for example, the mindfulness meditation with the client, made terrific use of the session, and I would contend that 1 minute, the first minute, was the most important part of the entire session, because that's a tool that they put into practice, into an output channel, because any time that they need that, they can do always a mindfulness meditation. And that's also a model of what we do in coaching, because in a mindfulness meditation, you get relaxed, you focus only on your breath. If anything comes up, a thought or whatever, you let it go and refocus on your breath. Same thing we do with clients. So this is important, I think, as we begin to work with clients. So let's talk a little bit more about how to regulate states of mind. The most important thing we can do to achieve success, personally, professionally, business, is to manage emotions and regulate state of mind. So what do you think these people have in common? John Belushi, Marilyn Monroe, Elvis Presley, Janis Joplin, F. Scott Fitzgerald, Kurt Cobain. They never learned the critical success strategy of managing their states of mind. To use drugs or alcohol or some other substance or process to regulate a state of mind and manage emotions can be a significant compromise. And your state for performance, your state of mind, the particular software program you develop in terms of deliberate practice and then use, determines how you engage and how successfully you engage whatever you decide to do. And your state of mind determines the meaning we attach, and the meaning determines the behavior. So by changing the state of mind, we change the behavior. So when Barbara saw her dad roll his eyes, for example, she knew, and it wasn't instant. There's nothing magical about it. It's a hard work miracle. She recognized early in the process, she didn't go as deeply or as fully in that whole reactive process, because in that second column, it's a time capsule. The things in that second column, the negative self-talk, the I don't think I can do it, all of that, that will never change. That's why people get stuck in therapy for two reasons. It's a time capsule, and it's not going to change in that state. And every time you try to engage that state to try to change it, you enter the problem, which further etches the pathway in your brain to the problem. So people get stuck and frustrated. What we do in coaching is very different. We're focusing on the choice architecture, as we talked last time, of this moment, of now and next. And first, before the choice, is to regulate a state of mind, because that will determine the meaning you attach and then how you process it. So this neural conditioning chart, the four columns that we just talked about, are things that you can think about doing to regulate a state of mind to get in state for optimum practice and optimum performance. And I'm being redundant for those of you who did the earlier performance seminar series with me. So, and I want to be sure that this answers your questions about that. And what also is a component of this is how you frame something. We touched a little bit last time on how you frame what you experience. Our brain can't tell the difference between anxiety and excitement. So if you frame it as anxiety, that boots up a specific mindset that handles danger, and the result is better head for cover or withdraw or do something to protect yourself, because from evolutionary times, that's our response to an animal coming toward us on the savannah. Now, the other is to frame it as excitement, as possibility, as opportunity. That boots up a very different mindset. And when you're grounded and present and look for opportunity, it creates an entirely different experience. An example here. One of the things I don't think we incorporate nearly enough is appreciative inquiry. Dr. David Copywriter did studies in organizations where the usual question of a consultant is a problem solving. The group presents a problem or a challenge. The consultant looks at different aspects of it and presents a solution, an answer. Same thing happens when you go to a doctor. Now, half of the organizations, he did something different than problem solving. Instead of problem solving, instead of the focus on problem and his having the answers, he began to ask the people what their thoughts were, what the challenges were. He framed it as challenges and opportunities so that they engaged with him to co-create something new and different. What happens then in their brains, each person who participated, was they began to create new pathways and look at things in different ways. Significantly greater results and greater appreciation of the process in looking at solution-based and challenge-based rather than problem-based. So this has application for groups as well as individuals. So it's something that some of you have heard me talk about. This is the most difficult thing to teach or to do mentor coaching with one group in particular, professional athletic coaches, because they know, and they know that they know what every player on that field or court needs to do. Unequivocally, they know. It's been their life. But yet when they tell them, it's baffling or frustrating because it doesn't work. So the hardest thing is to not know the answer and give somebody else the answer, because that only fortifies what they already believe. And as we touched on a bit last time, you present a belief you have, the person who hears you compares it to their belief. If they agree with you, then they'll confirm it. Confirmation bias. If they don't agree with you, they'll refute it. So either way, it's the boomerang effect that neuroscientists call it. They're entrenched further in their original position rather than taking in new information. So what do you do in a situation like that? Ask a question. Think about your experience with that. If you've been around, if you have, I need to speak no further, experience with your adolescent, if you remember being an adolescent, or if you engage with any adolescents, just try telling them something and see what happens. If you ask a question, you engage them. There's nothing to oppose. You began together in a collaborative way. This is exactly what we do in mentor coaching. Our first response to a client is, what would you like us to focus on today? You ask from them what they want to determine. It's their map, their story, and then where would you like to get to? That's the rest of the map. Then you're in a collaborative framework to together explore instead of giving them ideas. So this is a beginning of a framework of collaboration that I believe is unique to what we do in professional coaching. And think about every other professional, a doc, an attorney, a financial professional. It's the consultation model. You go into a doc and tell the doc what's going on. The doc gives you a remedy, a story. And many of you have heard this before, and I want to reiterate this. Let's say the story is in the form of a prescription. How well does that work? Well, less than 50% of prescriptions given by physicians are actually filled. And this is when the patient is in pain and motivated to schlep across town and expose themselves because you can't do the first visit usually on video. So of those that are filled, less than 50% are actually taken as directed. So even when somebody consults an expert, the result is that less than 1 in 4 follows this expert advice even when they're highly motivated to do so. Why? Well, it's the way our brains are designed to work. It's the doctor's story, not the patient's story. The patient is designed to look at and see if there's agreement, to look at what kind of things may fit or not. Collaboration is a very different mindset. There's nothing to oppose. When you try it, try it on the next teenager that you encounter. So this is about neural conditioning too, and this is something we can listen for. Whatever you associate to a stimulus determines our behavior. It boots up a particular mindset. So looking at this process, it's not enough just to think positively. And many of you have also heard me say, if information were enough, we'd all work out every day, we'd eat mostly vegetables, we'd have a lot of money saved up for the future, and a lot of librarians would be billionaires. But information only creates the scenario that I mentioned, the dilemma of the pro sports coach. So thinking positively isn't enough. The stimulus response is there in your brain, even if you don't believe it or know it's there. Think about this, and I think even those of you who are of recent generations, well, Winston tastes good. You know, what's your association? For 80% of people, even up to the cusp of the current generation, like a cigarette should. Even if you don't smoke, even if you think it's horrible, it's still there. It's the link. Even if you link smoking and cancer, that phrase is still there. What you link inside your head, the meaning you give, determines your behavior. And often our choices, not often, our choices are ultimately determined, even though it's not conscious or logical or intellectual, by our identity. And think about neuroeconomists can hook somebody, let's say you hook a group of 10 people up to an fMRI to look at what's happening in their brain. And you show each of these 10 people 8 different items. You can, with over 95% of accuracy, if they are instructed to purchase one thing, you can predict over 95% of the time what one of those 8 things they see they'll purchase. How's that happen? Because they have brain activation in a part of their brain that has to do with their sense of self, and that's an actual brain location. There's activity because it fits their identity. So this is what we want to keep in mind as a bedrock of working with clients in mind and brain mastery and application, is that their foundation is what we want to understand, their needs and their ideals, their values, because those are so fundamental and need to fit with the strategy and the goals that we work on with them, because this is part of their compass, their sense of purpose. Now, a couple of things to consider. An association gets linked when it's anchored with some particular meaning. Now, here's an overview. There are two forces behind all behavior. I described the bedrock of identity, but here's what's the foundation layered on top of that bedrock: the desire to gain pleasure and the need to avoid pain. When we associate gaining pleasure, we move toward. If we associate it with avoiding pain, we may move away from it to prevent pain, to protect ourselves. That's an evolutionary principle too. So to understand the motivating forces of pain and pleasure, the need to avoid pain is biological. Our brains fight against change to avoid pain. And that's biologically rooted, even though it may not make sense logically. Trying to create more success by creating more pain, unless achieving that success, usually doesn't work. Now, at any moment, the pleasure of eating may feel greater than the pain of the compromise of health or the later weight or anything like that. The pleasure of cheesecake is more enjoyable than the pain of the idea of being out of shape, being fat. And especially that's tough with strawberry topping. Now, overweight or health is an abstract idea, not at the same level of sensory reality as immediate pleasure. So that's exactly why people spend, why people eat, because it's the anticipation of the pleasure that motivates. It's not the result of the pleasure chemical dopamine. That's what we know now. Here's an example of that. We once thought that dopamine, the pleasure chemical, was the reward for doing certain behavior. It's not. It happens before. If you hook a number of people, gamblers and non-gamblers, up with an fMRI as they approach a slot machine, the spike of dopamine will occur even before they touch that slot machine, more so with gamblers. It's the anticipation. I learned many years ago, back when I was still practicing psychiatry, I didn't know this from a brain level. It just kind of went in the back door. I had an eating disorders treatment program and worked with people from all over the world, and had an opportunity to ask a number of young women. Let me just focus on one particular question that I would ask and learn to ask, finally, young women who were bulimic. At what point in the process of using food to change the way you feel, do you notice feeling different? 100% of them recognized that it was the instant before food ever touched their lips. They recognized that and could then see not only was food a prop in a process, it was an unnecessary prop, and they learned then different ways to create that way of changing and regulating their own mindset. So that became a real insight for them. And here's back to the what I introduced about need to avoid pain or desire to gain pleasure. It's there in every decision we make. An example of gain, promotion, make more money, improve our lives, get what you desire. An example of preventing pain, to avoid change. We buy insurance. We save money. We stay away from something we're afraid of. Now, here's a way to use that in coaching. Someone has a plan, and that's the first question, if they're stuck in something or if they procrastinate with something. Do you have a plan? Because that's our work. That's what we do, is help somebody have a plan and then to put it into play. So those are the two things we do. That's what we get past, why we get paid big money. So do you have a plan? If we're working with somebody, we know darn well they have a plan. So at what point do you stop yourself? And whatever the story is, they'll bargain with themselves, say, I'm going to do it next Tuesday, or stop themselves and replace it with some thing from that column two. I don't think I'm, let's say, I want to generate more income and create wealth. But then they stop themselves. They have a plan, but stop themselves. You know, at that instant, the frame, immediately in your mind, just before you stop, what's your internal conversation? And they'll say, well, you know, I say to myself, I don't really think I have what it takes, or I just wasn't made to have money. Or money has always had really powerful meanings in our family, and that just seems to replace what I'm doing. So at that instant, then, they're not procrastinating because they're sabotaging themselves. They're avoiding an anticipated pain. So at that juncture, at that instant, that nanosecond that they replace the next step forward with that internal conversation, then that's where the choice architecture is, that next step. You know, what can you do to proceed? What's worked in the past? Or here are the two questions around the dual motivations of avoiding pain and seeking pleasure. What will you be glad you've done? And you may even put it in a framework of a day from now, a week from now, 5 months. And if you stop yourself, how will you feel? And the avoiding pain has an immediate payoff in that it alleviates anxiety, but there's no gain beyond that. Now, what will the pain be if I do this? The need for focus. What's the pain if you don't follow through? What will be the cost and the pain if you don't do it? So we're defined by the stories we tell, and this is a story, a kind of a microscopic story we're telling ourselves at a specific juncture. Most people are stuck because of the story they tell themselves, the one that came from 10 years ago, or a time capsule like Barbara's that will never change, even with therapy. It won't change because it's a time capsule by definition. So what we deal with in coaching is now and next, the framing of what and how we can engage. And we frame the engagement with the client in the way that they're downloading that model that we're using resonate with their experience to look at collaborating to look at a next step. They're resonating with that while they're downloading that way of connecting to themselves and self-regulating, even though it may not be a specific exercise. They're always downloading everything we're talking about and the whole process of that as we're engaging with them. So this is what we're doing. This is how the client is showing you what it's like to be that person and how we're responding to that to create a model together actively to experience something different. So then how do you condition yourself to make changes that last? This is related especially to a couple of the questions that you asked. The best way, in fact, the only way for permanent change is to create a system that will last and incorporate the changes into your identity. We always return to our identity. So this is something we need to listen for as we're engaged with a client, is how do we help that client understand and transform that change into a new operating model of how and who they are. So how do you condition yourself to make changes at last? This is in the back to the outline. One, identify what to change. And a client usually, by the time they engage with, they're, even though their brain is constructed to repeat, to stick with the default story and the default mode, and every step into something new and different will generate trepidation or anxiety, that's a reframing right there. This is a signpost to being in new territory, not an indication that your intuition is telling you this is not the right thing or this is a mistake or my gut says not to do it. We're going to talk about the use of intuition and how for new and different situations, like the vampire problem, and whatever you wrote down as your different experience never before, how intuition can be misleading because intuition is that unconscious processing and simulation from existing models and kicking it up to the forebrain, the left prefrontal cortex, to make it logical and conscious. And if there's not an operating model, that's where you come into play. So identify what to change. So someone has to get to the point that they know they must, can, and will change. And that not changing is going to be ultimately more painful than the pain of the change process and doing something new and different, uncharted, or simply that they've never done before. So to believe that change will ultimately bring pleasure. And this is the collaboration. They're not doing it alone. You and the client are doing it together. So questions for this step, if you don't change that pattern, what will be the consequences? What's the pain associated to that choice that may seem adaptive or at least avoiding pain? What will the pleasure be with changing? Secondly, you have to interrupt the existing pattern. You can't just add something new. You can't just add a gym club membership and think that that's going to change things. Think about that. Reflect back on your experience. So recognize the cues for the behavior that you want and need to change. Think about the example with Barbara. She wrote down the specific emotional triggers that would set her off and instantly prompt entrance into, falling into, actually, that time capsule. So the awareness then had to be of that in order instead to move across to do the cue, the focus, the physiology, and then to have a plan for that. So when you interrupt the existing pattern, the couple of questions, what are the cues or the triggers for that automatic pattern And then think of ways to interrupt that pattern, to recognize it, because it's going to, your brain's hardwired to do, you're going to move right immediately, instantly into that reaction, but learn to recognize it a little bit sooner each time, a little bit less depth into the response emotionally each time. It's a process, and it gets a little better each time. So the question here that we've already is, what are the cues or triggers for that automatic pattern? And then think of ways to interrupt that pattern once you've identified it, or especially when you're in the middle of it. So 3, create a new association that empowers you. After getting grounded and centered, the column 3, create a new association, a new behavior, a new meaning, so that for Barbara, for example, the way her mother would ask her a question that was immediately triggering, her dad would roll her eye, she learned to recognize that and say, I understand, to herself, I understand how human they are, and I can appreciate that as whatever it was to protect her or to respond to her. And she reframed it, in other words. So what's the new association to that familiar cue or trigger? What's the change you want to bring about? What's the ideal behavior? The column 4. So think about all the things you gain and the pleasure you have with that change. It may not be immediate. If it's the cheesecake, it is not immediate, but the first 2 or 3 bites, all the pleasure's over anyhow. So think about 5 minutes or the next day, or at night when you reflect on, oh, that cheese. So think about that aspect then. So these are some aspects that we talk about with self-regulation. So self-control is more immediate. You know, get a hold of yourself, push through this and do it. Or, you know, look at what's the next best thing. But self-regulation involves creating an optimum state of mind so that you can access all the information in each of our different states of mind. And this is what, let me give you one example of that. Let me see if we have time to do that. I may save this example for a time when we have a little bit more time, because I'd like to get your responses and feedback right now as a response to what we've talked about, and to look at that. If you like the example and don't have any questions, I'll move directly into that. But I wanna go to open mic to discussion mode in case there are questions and things that you have as comments or clarification. Okay, and thank you for managing background noise. I really need a management of the background noise. Mute *6. Okay, somebody's walked away, so I'm going to go back to lecture mode and give you the example. So hold on. Okay, the example of this is, I'll call him Seth, a successful CPA with his own accounting firm who functioned brilliantly when he was concentrating on a specific task. He was dynamite, but his focus became derailed by a lot of distractions during the day. He had a dozen associates who worked for him, and he would be fielding telephone calls and curbside consults throughout the day and lose his focus, his attention and concentration. And each time he was interrupted, he had to disengage from what he concentrated on to give his full attention to the issue presented, the curbside consult of the associate, and then he returned to address his project or his focus. Triple work, 3 state changes. Each state change takes cognitive energy. And each of these tasks that I mentioned is a different mindset with focused attention, and each transition then takes energy to navigate the state change. He recognized how disruptive and impractical this process was for his energy and effectiveness. He had even wondered if he had attention deficit disorder. And this is what I'm about to discuss in a coaching approach, has been useful in a number of instances when I've done mentor coaching with other coaches who have had ADD or clients, executives, professionals who have. So some similar principles. We collaborated on a simple structure that he would focus without interruption on his important task. He decided to concentrate his best creative time, the first 2 hours of each business day, on his business plan to expand to a regional firm. He then planned specific times during the day to consult with his associates for their questions, and his assistant would manage that. So he had the consults with each of his associates for a particular time, from 4 to 5 each day. And before that, they knew not to bug him, not to interrupt him. A specific time to respond to emails, and then a specific time that he would return telephone calls, which helped his assistant because she could ask, at what number will you be when he returns calls at 3:30? So his assistant coordinated his schedule for each of these time blocks that required focused attention. So each day, he decided additionally to create a map for that day. He worked at a desktop Mac, so he had a lot of margins on the left and right. He decided to put a map for each day, the structure of the day, hour by hour, on the left, on a post-it note, and then on the right, he would look at that hour and the detailed specific approach and replace it every hour so he knew exactly where he was and what was next each time. He created a system. So this focused way of approaching things with a weekly and then a daily and then an hourly schedule helped him stay oriented and focused to give his full measure of attention to each task. He enjoyed things more, he was more productive, and he developed a very successful regional firm. So I'm going to go back for our last minute or two to discussion mode and to see if there are questions. I want to be sure you manage the background noise. Hold on. Okay, we're in open mic, and questions or comments from anyone. I'm very interested in your take on this. And I hope you were able to hang with me, even though we departed somewhat from the outline, for me to incorporate some of the questions and issues that you brought up. Anything to add or ask today? Well, I want to encourage you, as many of you have done, to think about these two questions if you haven't sent that in, or send any comments or questions you'd like discussed, and I'll incorporate it briefly at least at the beginning of the next seminar. So feel free to send me comments, questions, suggestions. I want to stick basically to the outline and what we're supposed to talk about, but I want to incorporate what is of most meaning and relevant for application that you have to orbit around the basic material, and I'll find a way to work that in as well. So thank you for your energy, your attention, and for the comments and questions you've sent me, and I encourage you to let me know and give me any feedback as well as things you'd like us to talk about for this to be of optimum benefit for each of you. So thanks very, very much. We'll pick up right here next time. Thank you, guys.
Thank you.